lovely time, I think. But I thought today I'd talk briefly about cometary reservoirs as clues to planet formation. And this is work with Hal Leveson, almost all of it's done with Hal, and some of it's done with Luke Domes and Paul Weissman. And the goal of this kind of research is to use the dynamics of observed comets as clues to the reservoirs, which I'll describe as a scattered disk of Oort cloud, and then to use the properties of the reservoirs as clues to the formation process itself. And at least put constraints on that kind of thing. And Eugene was talking a little bit about the Kuiper belt itself. And let me talk a little bit about... Thank you. I'll put that up there. Okay. So the idea, very quickly then, in the short time that I've got, I just want to remind you that the comets that we see, the ones that have perihelia near, say, 2.5 AU or something that produce the things that we can observe easily, are divided up into two classes, the Jupiter family comets, those with Tisserand parameters with respect to Jupiter between 2 and 3, and those of the Halley type with T less than 2. This parameter turns out to be useful because even though Jupiter's not really on a circular orbit, turns out when you integrate comets for a long time, they preserve the Tisserand parameter quite well. So they tell us something, they're really a measure of their origin. And again, to summarize some work that we did in the late 90s, the simulations show, in fact, that this is carrying on from work suggested to Scott Tremaine and Tom Quinn and myself, that you really can get a very good agreement with this class of comets if you start with objects that are leaking from the trans-Neptunian region and move in. And so there's good agreement with the JFCs and indeed the Centaurs. We might be able to use the Centaurs ultimately as a test of how hot the population is, how dynamically hot the initial population is, because there are divergences between models in which you start with very cold, dynamically, say, very low inclination population, or somewhat hotter population, but they converge, the distributions converge when you get down to the JFC region. And the observations at the moment are not good enough to distinguish in great detail. But in principle, the Centaurs can tell us something about the distribution just beyond where the comets are really coming from. Now, one of the results of this work was that surprised us at the time was that if you started with a population of objects encountering Neptune in the early solar system and integrate them forward in time, that roughly 1% of the objects actually survive in a scattered disk just beyond, with perihelia typically just beyond Neptune. And the mechanism for that appears to be, at least in part, the fact that there are the mean motion resonances just beyond Neptune, the resonances with Neptune itself. Is there a focus in there?
I think it's actually on the lens.
That's a little better. Thank you. What happens is objects get trapped. If you have, for example, that this particular comet, which started scattering from, which entered the Hill sphere of Neptune at T equals zero, scatters all over the place, but occasionally gets trapped in, say, the 3 to 13 resonance and then the 4 to 7, not in it, but near the edge of it. And the perihelion can be lifted up, and that keeps it away from strong encounters with Neptune. And so the scattered disk can persist for 4 billion years when simple arguments about timescales for scattering suggest it should all be gone in 10 to the 8th years or so. So this was found in numerical simulations and then subsequently confirmed by observation. So the scattered disk is a major component of the trans-Neptunian region. And you might ask what happens to stuff in the scattered disk, or more generally what happens to all the stuff that was between the planets initially. Where did it all go, and how did it, what is its subsequent evolution? And this is just a very crude cartoon of what likely the distribution is. Somehow you've got stuff which started out here. As it moves out to greater distances, the galactic tidal field and passing stars, which don't change the semi-major axis very much of comets because it's very weak perturbation, but they easily, because they're so the orbits are so elongated, you can actually torque them by enough to move them out of the planetary region. So as you move out to large enough distances, objects become more randomized in their inclinations with respect to the solar system plane, and ultimately become sphericized as you get out to about 10,000 or 20,000 AU, and that's the Oort cloud. So The dynamics of all of that can be understood by using timescale arguments, and I guess I won't go into, I won't go into too much detail here, but let me try and explain this sort of complicated looking figure, but it does explain a lot about the dynamics of how we formed the Oort cloud and the evolution of things from the scattered disk, etc. So what's plotted is semi-major axis here, 100 AU to 10,000 AU. So the first time scale to look at is the orbital period, which we all know, and the log-log plot is a straight line. They all own these things apart. The other thing you might want to ask is, what happens if you start with an object that has a perihelion around Jupiter? What is its evolution? Once its semi-major axis gets out to about 100 AU or more, what happens is basically that every passage through the planetary region, there's a kick in energy. And you can work out what that is or numerically simulate it. And it turns out then that you'll get a diffusion in energy because the kick in energy is typically much less than the actual binding energy of the object until it gets out to about here where the orbital period is equal to the time it takes to get the next kick. And at that point, an object is lost. It's ejected typically when it gets out. If its perihelion is near 5, it gets kicked out of the system when its semi-major axis gets out to several hundred AU. If its peri is near 10, it can survive. It'll diffuse until it gets out to something less than 10,000 AU. And if its peri, the critical ones for our discussion are typically these out in here. If you can keep the paracenter near Uranus and Neptune, then the time scale for diffusion becomes very long, and these two points don't cross until out here. And that's where the red line becomes important, because the red line is the time scale for an object on an eccentric orbit to be torqued, to change its paracentric distance by about 10 AU in one orbital period. And that means that in the current system, when we have the galactic field that we now have, the torquing time scale looks like this. So you can imagine, for example, an object which is somewhere in this region. If you could get something that had Q on the order of, say, 20 AU, and you had it evolved by the planetary kicks, it would move out far enough until it got to a region here, let's say if it was right in this region. At this point, the torquing time is equal to the energy diffusion time. That means that the time scale to change its Q by 10 AU becomes shorter than the time to diffuse any further out. So at that point, objects can be lifted out into the Oort cloud and they can survive. So the nice, gentle, kinder, gentler evolution that you need in order to produce Oort clouds by the conventional method is for paracenters to be out in the outer parts of the solar system. Things in here are typically kicked out. Now, something that'll be relevant later is that if you increase the density, or if you have more passing stars, the sort of thing we're just hearing about, if the solar system were in an environment earlier in which the torquing time was a lot faster, then you could have things lifted out earlier and a denser inner cloud. The final point to note about this is that this point right here is relevant because this is the point where in one orbital period, the galactic tidal field is capable of torquing something by 10 AU. The reason that's important is that if you had something which was outside the solar system, say, you know, peri of 20 or 30 or even 40 AU, then something coming from this region beyond 20,000 AU can, in one orbital period, have its perihelion shifted from that which is beyond the solar system to one which brings it in very close to the sun. And that's where we see all the comets coming from. That's the reason, is that the tidal torque is sufficiently rapid in that region that you can leap over all the planets, and you can go from being beyond the planets to being injected into something you can see immediately, and that's where the Oort cloud is coming from. So I wanted to say two things about the things that we're trying to do numerically now, and their problems. The first problem is the following. I mentioned that the scattered disk, this population of low inclination stuff beyond Neptune, doesn't produce Halley-type comets very effectively. So the question is, where do they come from? And we've investigated that by doing numerical simulations with lots of test particles, placing particles with A's between 5,000 and 50,000 AU, and watching what happens to them. Monitoring their evolutions requires a lot of computer time, but ultimately you produce a few objects which have periods which are less than 200 years. And you ask, what's their distribution look like? How do they compare to the Halley-type comets? And if you start with an isotropic distribution, such as you see from the Oort cloud, we see new comets, comets coming from beyond 20,000 AU, come in from random directions, and they're coming from an isotropic distribution. It turns out that the Halley-type comets are most likely coming from either the inner Oort cloud or the scattered disk, as I'll say in a moment. If they're coming from the inner Oort cloud, we can try and match the inclination distributions, and it does not agree well with a spherical distribution, which tells us something about the otherwise unobservable regions of the solar system, which lie beyond the scattered disk and not out to the Oort cloud. You need something that looks qualitatively like this. You need a very flattened distribution in the inner regions of the Oort cloud, and relatively massive, because this population is very inefficient at injecting comets into this region. So you either need a very massive inner Oort cloud or something else. And then the final thing I wanted to say today.
What is massive? What do you mean by massive?
Well, it's hard to estimate the exact numbers because the diffusion in there is somewhat dependent on the distribution. But much more massive than the outer Oort cloud, for example.
Are you talking about one Earth mass?
Well, say the outer cloud has a few Earth masses. You might need, I don't know the numbers, but it's many Earth masses. It might be 10, it might be 100.
Is it comparable to the minimum mass nebula?
I don't think I can answer that except to say that it could be several Earth masses, which wouldn't be a problem if you could get them into that region to begin with. And that leads me to the next point, which is the following. That we have tried to simulate the formation of the Oort cloud. We did this, Quinn and Tremaine and I did this in 87, but we had to make approximations at that time. The approximations we had to make at that time were to start with comets that were already on very eccentric orbits because the numerics at the time couldn't handle detailed integrations. What we've done subsequently is to start a solar system which looks like ours, to spread small bodies in between the planets, the giant planets, and just beyond, and then integrate all the objects and see what happens during the scattering process. This includes then the effects of the planets in their current orbits, together with the existing galactic tidal field and passing stars. And you integrate for 4 billion years and you ask what happens to the entire population. And what's shown here are the different types of outcomes. Not shown here are the vast majority of comets which are actually ejected from the solar system. So the problem with this simulation, or the results of the simulation when compared with observation, is that are several fold. The first is that the outer Oort cloud, which is shown here, the number of comets that end up, that we start with, that end up in there, are about 2%. Those of you who may be familiar with the early work that we did with DQT, we were talking about tens of percent efficiency of populating the outer Oort cloud. And the reason that was so effective was that in that early work, we assumed that we had a distribution of objects that had perihelia near Neptune and semi-major axes of several hundred AU. In other words, the scattering process that formed all this had produced that population of objects. And the difficulty is that when you place objects down in near circular orbits, they begin to diffuse and scatter in semi-major axes, but they're much more likely to be passed inward, grabbed by Uranus, and then passed on to Saturn and Jupiter than they are to evolve to large semi-major axes and have their paracenters remain near Neptune. So what's happening is that things are being passed inward to Jupiter and Saturn, and they kick them right out of the solar system. They're very ineffective at landing things gently enough in the region between a few thousand and 20,000 AU, where the tides can have time to lift them out before they're kicked out. So there's a fundamental problem with a sort of standard model for the formation of the Oort cloud. It also produces an inner Oort cloud, which, as you can see, has about the same number of objects as the outer Oort cloud, and again, only 2%. So this would then correspond to something which, where the mass of the inner Oort cloud is comparable to the outer Oort cloud. That's not sufficient to produce the Halley-type comets. The other issue is the scattered disk that's produced in this. This, you remember, are the objects which have semi-major axes, just beyond, or semi-major axes beyond Neptune and paracenters just beyond Neptune, typically liberated by these trapping sticky resonances. That fraction falls off to roughly 1%, about 0.5% in fact. And so the population in the scattered disk would be within a factor of a few of the population in the Oort cloud. Now we know that the Oort cloud has something like 10 to the 12 comets in it. The scattered disk is thought not to contain, or it's not necessary for the scattered disk to contain more than maybe 10 to the 10 objects or even 10 to the 9 objects to explain the short period Jupiter family comets. So there's a disparity in here. So, in summary, the slow inclination disk seems to produce the JFCs but not the Halley type comets. About 1% of the objects encountering Neptune survive, so that's a good source for the JFCs. And it's roughly consistent with observations. Simulations of capture from the Oort cloud into Halley type objects are inconsistent with an isotropic source. So you need a flattened component. One possibility that we're working on right now is the scattered disk itself. If you think of the dynamics of the scattered disk, you have a population of objects which are left over. They've been scattered. So what they're doing is they're evolving slowly in semi-major axis, slowly because their paracenters are typically a little further out from Neptune. So that they evolve on timescales of hundreds of millions or billions of years. So some of them are evolving in, some of them leak in on the inner part, across Neptune, and then they're transported down to become JFCs. But there's the other population that's evolving outward, it's diffusion inward and outward. Some of them are diffusing out to distances of a few thousand AU. And there the tidal field can begin to act on them. And a fraction of those, roughly half of them, when they get out there, will be injected back in to orbits. And we know that the best kind of orbit to produce, initial orbit to produce a Halley-type comet, is something of relatively low inclination, which is encountering Saturn. That's just the results of the simulations. And a fraction of those objects from the scattered disk itself may be producing the Halley-type comets. There are questions of whether how well it works and with what efficiency. And so we'll have to work that out. But that's one possibility for producing the Halley-type. If so, this will be telling us something about the structure of the scattered disk. And then finally, what we really need to understand is how the Oort cloud is formed. Because if you start with existing planetary orbits and the existing galactic tidal field, the efficiency is very low, 2.5%. So if you're going to produce an Oort cloud, and as I said, 10 to the 12 objects or something, we don't know the exact mass of a comet, but estimates would suggest that that corresponds to many Earth masses, a few to many Earth masses in the classical Oort cloud, which we can see. So we know the numbers and we can estimate the mass that thereby. If you then have to multiply that by, you know, the inverse of the 0.025, you may end up with, you'd have to scatter out maybe hundreds of Earth masses with the material. That may lead to too much migration for Neptune, etc. So there's probably something that we're missing in all of this. And so the first thing we've tried is to put in migration models. Does an actual migrating system of planets sweeping out through the pristine region beyond, say, 10 or 15 AU, does that give a different Oort cloud? And the answer is no. It looks a lot like the one where we started in between. What else are we missing? We could be, obviously we have included masses that are growing. It could be the process that's going on while the giant planets, before Jupiter and Saturn, acquire all of their mass. Then they're much less efficient at scattering material. And so they might be able to scatter things further out and allow the tides to act. But that's a limited time over which they can act. There could be damping effects by gas. There could be physical collisions amongst the small bodies. And certainly there must be going on. And one possibility that Fernandez and others have talked about is maybe a denser galactic environment. But the problem with a denser galactic environment is it's one thing to say, well, geez, there's just a lot more stars going by, and things got out to a few thousand AU, and those tides, or effectively those tides, or those passing stars lifted them out. That's fine, but you've then got to be able to get them in a region where they can be injected again. I mean, there's no point in putting something in a very stable orbit out there at, say, 5,000 AU, lifting its paracenter out and then having it sit there, because you won't see them as Oort cloud comets, and they won't be injected in to form Halley-type comets either. So you have to have something which is capable of doing, producing things which are in the region where we can see them, and which but we'll see them later coming back. So that's, I think, the status of this problem, and that's what I wanted to tell you.
Our was the cluster environment in the early days.
No, and of course, just what I heard today, I was thinking about that. People have looked at this. Eggerman, I think, has done a thesis on some of that, and it helps. But I'm not sure it reproduces the observations.
Can you give us sort of a dimension, the comparison with beta pig, the boundary between your inner and outer voice cloud? Are we talking about sizes that's 10 times larger than the sort of beta pig?
Are you talking about which
beta pictorius?
No, but which population in our system are you talking about?
Well, I'm just talking about the difference. You know, you have the separation between inner and outer Oort cloud.
Okay, the outer Oort cloud is by this definition where we can see things being injected now. That's at 20,000 AUV. So the classical Oort cloud is the ones when you look at new comets coming in right now, they're highly concentrated. Their semi-major axis is very close to 24,000 AUV. That's because that's where the galactic tides are now effective at injecting them from that region. So that defines the inner edge of the classical, or the outer, what you call the outer Oort cloud. The inner cloud then is the one that is not normally observable, but is probably supplying the Hallett-type comets. And in the early work that we did with Quinn and Tremaine, the simulation suggested that the mass of that inner cloud would be about 5 times more massive than the outer cloud. So the outer cloud has a few Earth masses. This inner cloud would have tens of Earth masses in that picture. The latest simulations indicate that, in this naive model, that the numbers would be comparable. The inner cloud would have about an equal mass to the outer cloud. That's probably not enough to supply the Hallett-type comets. It doesn't produce a flattened distribution like that which we see, and it produces too many scattered disk objects. So there's something missing.
This is a nice question, but are the observations of comet orbits inconsistent with a flattened component at all?
Well, we cannot see comets. It's difficult enough to see things at 35 or 48 years.
Yeah.
So there's no direct observation of any orbit.
So nothing actually rules out a flattened component?
No.
Observation.
Nothing observationally rules it out. The question is, it's a theoretical issue, but how do you produce such a flattened distribution? How massive would it have to be? And then, and in our case, how do you form it? And so that's why these constraints, if we had a very good constraint on the Hallett-type comets, we might be able to put a very good constraint on, say, the mass of that inner cloud and its distribution. So that's the ultimate goal, is to infer, by looking at those few comets that eventually make their way down and form Hallett-type comets, we might be able to infer the structure of the inner cloud, and that's one of the goals. But there's no direct observational evidence for it. We don't see those comets coming in because when they're first injected, they typically have their cues are out in the outer planetary region. They are then drawn in by encounters with the outer planets, and they keep having those encounters, and when they're finally brought in to visibility, their semi-major axes are drawn so far down that we don't see the direct source.
The isotropic distribution of the information varied about the comets would imply that there's no flattened distribution out there.
That's correct.
But you need the flattened distribution just to account for how it is closer to the data.
That's correct. You're right. We know that the classical Oort cloud, the Oort cloud that Oort talked about, is isotropic, and he argued it would be isotropic because of the passing stars. So we've lost all memory. As you know, the planetary region is inclined at 60 degrees to the galactic plane. And so once things get out to distances like 10,000 or 20,000 AU, they lose all memory of what plane they started in because of the random nature of the forces that they're getting from the passing stars. So that's spherical. So we know that, and so that's why we had to have this really crude and unsatisfactory two-component model with a spherical outer part and a relatively flat inner part and relatively massive inner part. There's presumably a transition between the two, but we're not forming that inner cloud at all.
Well, you don't even form a flattened distribution.
It's a fairly sharp transition. At about 3,000 AU, things go from being quite flat to quite round. But there is a transition zone, yes, but it's not very big.
Okay. Thank you. There is one.